its entirety, black, brown, and beige represents a major step forward for Ellington, his boldest attempt to address the demands of longer forms. It suffered, if anything, from an abundance of riches, too much thematic material, too many shifts in tempo, too many moods. Yet for all its excesses, black, brown, and beige remains a career milestone for Ellington and deserves consideration as the most important extended work in the history of jazz music. With encouragement, Ellington might have pushed further in the directions outlined by this massive composition. Instead, the mixed reactions of the critics gave him pause. Over the next month, he performed the work two more times, then put it on the shelf, never again playing it in its original form. Ellington would continue to debut extended works at Carnegie Hall concerts during the 1940s, but none were as ambitious as Black, Brown, and Beige. In New World A-Coming, premiered at Carnegie Hall on December 11, 1943, Ellington offered a more controlled single-movement work, less jazz-oriented and with overtones of 19th-century classical music. With The Perfume Suite, which made its debut the following year, Ellington, with Strayhorn's participation evident, constructed a longer work out of a sequence of movements, which were essentially unrelated musical vignettes. Ellington employed the same approach, which allowed him to rely on his skills as a miniaturist, with the Deep South Suite from 1946 and the Liberian Suite from 1947. During the remainder of his career, this formula would remain Ellington's preferred method of dealing with the challenges of extended form. Over the next quarter of a century, Ellington would compose numerous longer works, but the more thematically probing style of Black, Brown, and Beige would rarely surface. Yet as Günther Schuller has rightly pointed out, before we judge Ellington too harshly, we might do well to remember that the whole question of large forms in jazz has not been entirely satisfactorily answered by anyone else. A decade after Black, Brown, and Beige, the introduction of the long-playing record was heralded as the breakthrough that would liberate jazz from the constraints imposed by 78 RPM records. Once jazz artists were no longer limited by the enforced 3-minute duration of a 78, an era of extended jazz composition would blossom, or so it seemed at the time. But the ensuing decades made clear that more than technological problems needed to be solved to effect such a liberation. Why is this so? Schuller points to the challenge of integrating improvisation and composition. Certainly, this is an issue. But even more pressing is the question, usually unacknowledged in jazz circles, of what a suitable compositional structure for longer jazz works might look like. In fact, there are only four options. On the one hand, jazz composers can borrow the forms of classical music, creating jazz operas, jazz fugues, jazz sonatas, and the like. Second, jazz composers can continue to use the short forms, 12-bar blues, 32-bar forms, and simply play them for a longer time or string them together in suites. Third, longer works can be created that are essentially formless or very lax in imposing formal constraints, as with Ellington's many suites. Finally, jazz composers can invent their own compositional structures, not a jazz sonata, but an alternative to sonata form, or fugue, rondo, etc., for the jazz idiom, whatever that might be. The last option is clearly the most difficult, probably the most promising, and certainly the one least explored to date. Not surprisingly so, given the limited concern with, and at times antagonism against, formalism that predominates in the jazz world. When commentators lament Ellington's reliance on essentially formless suites in his later years, it is not because of their lack of quality, far from it, but because Ellington seemed to be shirking the larger task at hand. More than any other jazz composer of the 20th century, he possessed the vision, ambition, and genius necessary to create these new structures. Did Ellington fail in this regard? Not really. At a certain point, he simply decided to direct his energies elsewhere. At times, his most daring musical visions would emerge in brief sketches, as in the 4.5-minute rendition of The Clothed Woman from his 1947 Carnegie Hall concert, with its hints of atonality mixed in with elements of stride and blues. The integration of vocal and instrumental lines in Transbluency, the use of counterpoint on Fuga Ditty, which also served as part of the longer tonal group, the canonic interplay and daring reharmonization from the band's 1945 remaking of Mood Indigo, these too showed Ellington's interest in expanding his musical vocabulary. As the last piece made clear, the reworking of old material often gave rise to some of Duke's most inspired moments. 5 years later, Ellington created a 15-minute version of Mood Indigo for one of his first long-playing records, and the resulting 16 choruses of variations on this theme must rank as one of the band's greatest, if often overlooked, longer works. This may well have been the closest Ellington ever came to creating an African-American equivalent of Bach's Goldberg Variations or Beethoven's Diabelli Variations. And the hits continued as well. Even during the recording ban, Ellington continued to enjoy success as a composer of popular songs. Two of Ellington's instrumental numbers were given a makeover, with the addition of lyrics and a new name, and made into hits. Don't Get Around Much Anymore, based on Never No Lament, reached the top of the R&B chart in a version by the Inkspots, and spurred Victor to re-release Ellington's own version, which also sold well. A simplified version of Concerto for Cootie enjoyed popularity when rechristened as Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. In addition to building his reputation as a songwriter and concert hall composer, Ellington managed somehow to deal with the many other demands on him, the demands of the road, the demands of leading a big band, the demands of celebrity, the demands imposed by commercial interests in the music industry, these continuing for the rest of his life. Time was always in short supply. Even the unscheduled work, Billy Strayhorn once quipped, is behind schedule. In this context, the marvel is that Ellington succeeded so well on so many different fronts. The 1950s proved to be a challenging decade for Ellington. The sudden departure of Johnny Hodges, Lawrence Brown, and Sonny Greer in 1951 stands out as the most devastating loss in the history of the band. Ellington regrouped by arranging for the return of Juan Tissol from his gig with Harry James, along with Tissol's cohorts in that band, drummer Louis Belson and alto saxophonist Willie Smith. The jazz press dubbed the move the Great James Robbery, but the take on this heist was questionable. There were, clearly, some benefits. Belson proved to be generally superior to Greer in driving the band on up-tempo charts, but the departure of Hodges left Duke with a gap that simply could not be filled by Smith for all his virtues or anyone else. Hodges would return in 1955, but Ellington never fully adjusted to his absence in the interim. Much of the slack was taken up by saxophonist Paul Gonsalves, whose arrival in 1950 provided Ellington with his strongest tenor soloist of the post-Webster decades. The addition of trumpeter Clark Terry in the following year, however, was clearly a major coup for Duke. But coping with bandstand turnover was only a small part of Ellington's challenge during this period. At least that could be managed more or less. The changing musical tastes of the American public was another factor entirely. By 1950, the big band was effectively dead as a major force in American popular music. In the years following World War II, a number of social and economic factors conspired to force the big band slowly, but inexorably, out of existence. A tax on dance venues, later repealed, may have been the first wedge separating jazz musicians from their mass audience. In the post-war years, the cost of promoting swing music further escalated as the price of transportation, wages, and hotel rooms rose steadily. An increasingly foreboding reputation for jazz as a music for serious listeners only, a legacy of the beboppers, clearly dates from this period as well. In time, the spread of television not only encouraged people to stay at home, but distracted the public's attention from radio, which had provided free advertising for jazz music in the previous two decades. But swing music itself was also partly to blame, its vital core enervated by the formulaic gestures of the name bands and the sound-alike sameness of the second-tier groups. The public's taste was now shifting to pop singers, such as Frank Sinatra, and soon would embrace the transgressive sounds of rock and roll. Perhaps no single factor was pivotal in killing the big band, but the cumulative impact was enormous. In December 1946, no fewer than 8 major swing orchestras disbanded, including those of Goodman, James, Dorsey, and Teagarden. By the close of the decade, only a few surviving units continued to work with any regularity, and in later years, a number of the most prominent exponents of swing were so-called ghost bands, a fitting label for these semi-moribund ensembles, boasting the names of now-departed leaders with perhaps only a few holdovers in the orchestra from the glory days. These emblematic ensembles on life support continued to regurgitate the hits of earlier years without even a pretense of novelty or innovation. The leaders who continued to program new big band music now struggled as never before. The story of Count Basie during the post-war years offers a telling example. Dance hall and hotel engagements steadily declined for his band, forcing Basie into smaller clubs such as Bop City and the Royal Roost. Sales of his recordings for the Victor label were poor, and quality suffered as the label sought desperately for gimmicks to revive the band's popularity. Basie was finally forced to disband in early 1950. His agent of long standing, Willard Alexander, went so far as to issue a statement to the press acknowledging that the Basie Big Band had been destroyed as a box office attraction. The Count was left to front a decimated sextet. A less committed bandleader might have given up, but Basie fought back. He soon expanded to a septet when veteran guitarist Freddie Green unilaterally decided that the band couldn't get by without him. "He just came in on his own," Basie described Green's return. "One night we were playing somewhere in Midtown, and I came to work, and there he was with his guitar and everything. He's been right there ever since." When important gigs came up, Basie would add extra players. Slowly he reestablished his big band on an ongoing basis, rebuilding his core of soloists along the way. The so-called New Testament Band, described in greater detail in Chapter 6, may not have eclipsed listeners' memories of Lester Young and Herschel Evans, who could, but nonetheless, it made a major contribution to the Basie legacy. Ellington's history during the decade of the 1950s followed a similar course. At one point, his stature had fallen so low that a writer in Downbeat urged Duke to retire from band leading. This was extreme, even given Downbeat's tabloid-like penchant at the time for stirring controversy. Yet few could deny that the first half of the 1950s represented a low point in the history of the Ellington Band. Ellington was increasingly content to rely on pieces from earlier decades. Only one substantial extended composition was written and recorded during these years, the 14-minute tone poem, Harlem. But it is a masterpiece by almost any measure. And with his 1953 recordings of Satin Doll, Ellington showed himself still capable of writing a radio airplay hit, although this would be his last. Perhaps the most refreshing development of the later Ellington was his higher profile as a pianist and combo performer. His 1953 piano record for Capitol is a major statement for Ellington as both a player and composer, Reflections in D and Melancholia. In the following years, Ellington would make several other albums in this vein with positive results. His occasional collaborations with leading players of the younger generation, Charles Mingus, Max Roach, John Coltrane, also produced some of his most creative moments as small combo pianist. At the same time, a pronounced conservatism is evident in Ellington's big band work from these years. After two decades of continually reinventing his sound, Ellington's musical vocabulary evolved little after the close of the 1940s. The melodic and rhythmic innovations of modern jazz held little fascination for him. Except for token gestures, a gratuitous rock-inflected piece, or a passing hint of bop, his efforts focused on reworking the fields he had plowed in earlier decades. And while other bandleaders, Stan Kenton, Gil Evans, sought out exotic instruments to add color to their orchestrations, Ellington appeared content to remain within the confines of the traditional swing band. In this light, it comes as little surprise that the turning point for Ellington in the 1950s was spurred by his revival of a composition almost 20 years old, Diminuendo and Crescendo in Blue. Ellington's raucous performance of this piece at the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival electrified the audience. Within an hour, reporters and critics were buzzing about it, Ellington's record company proudly proclaimed. By next morning, it was generally conceded to have been one of the most exciting performances any of them had ever heard. There was a tinge of irony in this praise. The fans were ecstatic not about Ellington's composition, or his orchestration, or even his pianism. Rather, it was tenorist Paul Gonsalves's showboating 27 chorus solo, filled to the brim with blues cliches and occasional snatches of inspiration, that brought the crowd to its feet. Ellington's career now had a second wind. Only a few months before Newport, interest in his band had sunk so low that Duke had resorted to playing background music for the Aquacades, a water show staged outside New York City. Better bookings were now coming his way. Ellington's picture graced the cover of Time magazine. His band was again recording for a major label. On the heels of Newport, Ellington recorded Such Sweet Thunder, an impressive collaboration with Billy Strayhorn, which ranks among their finest moments. Television beckoned, with CBS featuring his 1957 A Drum is a Woman. The film industry was not far behind, commissioning Ellington to compose the score for Anatomy of a Murder in 1959 and Paris Blues in 1961. and many of the older players were returning to the fold. Johnny Hodges in 1955, Lawrence Brown and Juan Tissol in 1960, Cootie Williams in 1962. In his final years, Ellington's position as a public figure threatened to overwhelm his purely musical pursuits. He took on the role of elder statesman for the jazz world, traveling to Asia, Australia, North Africa, Latin America, Europe, and Russia. His 70th birthday was celebrated at the White House. French President Georges Pompidou named him to the Legion of Honor. Haile Selassie of Ethiopia awarded him the Emperor's Star. The Pulitzer Prize was almost presented to him in 1965, but the decision was overruled at the last minute when the Pulitzer Board rejected the recommendation of the music jury, a disgraceful move at the time, which looks worse with every passing year. Doubleday paid Ellington a $50,000 advance for an autobiography, unheard of at the time for a jazz book, which eventually resulted in his elegant kiss-and-tell little memoir, Music is My Mistress. Of course, there were always new musical pieces, and they continued to bespeak grand ambitions, suites commemorating Ellington's travels, Far East Suite, Latin American Suite, or the Jazz Heritage, New Orleans Suite, coexisting alongside hoary classical adaptations, Peer Gynt, The Nutcracker. Yet the appearance of originality, in a title or dedication, could not disguise the fact the Duke was mostly working over familiar territory. Mount Harissa, from the Far East Suite, sounds superficially exotic, but the chord changes are essentially the same as in Take the A-Train. Latin American Suite found Ellington tackling the idiomatic music of that region, but then again, hadn't he already pioneered this decades earlier with his masterful Latin-tinged works from the 1940s? Ellington's massive and moving sacred concerts also appeared to break new ground as well, but even here he drew on earlier compositions such as Come Sunday. Time after time, Ellington's huge ambitions were invariably measured against the even larger proportions of his own past work. These later pieces were not without their virtues. Most have held up surprisingly well with the passing years. But Ellington's works were no longer seen as path-breaking or progressive by most jazz fans and critics. And in the hothouse jazz environment of the 1960s, where being at the cutting edge was lauded as the ultimate virtue, Ellington could no longer demand center stage. Meanwhile, outside the jazz world, only rock and Rolling Stones dotted the desolate landscape of popular music. In this context, few could appreciate the gems that Ellington or Strayhorn still composed. Isfahan, Heaven, Blood Count. Ellington, for his part, increasingly gravitated to settings, overseas or inside the White House, where he could flourish as an unofficial ambassador for jazz, a role for which this Duke was perfectly suited. But many of the most seasoned veterans of the Ellington band were now passing away or slipping quietly into retirement. Billy Strayhorn's death in 1967 devastated Ellington, depriving him of a close friend and an integral part of his creative life. He responded with a tribute album, and his mother called him Bill, which stands out as perhaps his most emotionally charged project of the decade, rivaled only by the sacred concerts. In 1970, Johnny Hodges died suddenly during a routine dental visit. Jimmy Hamilton left in 1968, Lawrence Brown in 1970, Cat Anderson in 1971. Paul Gonsalves died only a few days before Ellington in 1974. The Ellington Band, in its final days, had become faceless, almost unthinkable given its history of strong musical personalities. In January 1974, Ellington was briefly hospitalized in Los Angeles and diagnosed with lung cancer. Released after 8 days, Duke returned to the road and the incessant demands of new musical projects. In March 1974, he left the band in mid-tour to check into the Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. Here, he gave in begrudgingly to his illness, yet insisted on having an electric piano brought to his bedside so he could continue work on his comic opera, Queenie Pie. On May 24th, he died of pneumonia. Ellington's funeral was held 3 days later, on Memorial Day, with over 10,000 people paying their respects in person, in addition to the numerous eulogies and testimonials from fans and friends around the world. Günther Schuller compared Ellington to Bach, Beethoven, and Schoenberg. President Nixon praised him as the nation's foremost composer. The New York Times concurred in its front-page obituary, citing him as America's most important composer. The passing years have validated this high-flown praise. Ellington's death marked only a brief pause in the expansion of his legacy. On the day of his funeral, Ellington's son Mercer took up his father's baton to lead the band at a Bermuda engagement. The Duke would have wanted it that way, he explained to a reporter. Mercer Ellington also saw to the completion of Duke's Queenie Pie and its premiere in Philadelphia in 1986. But the continuing activity of the band was only a small part of the posthumous explosion of Ellingtonia. Gary Giddens has estimated that, in the decade following Ellington's death, some 50 hours worth of previously unissued music was commercially released. These works, including virtually complete versions of important Carnegie Hall concerts from the 1940s, only served to reinforce Ellington's glowing and still growing reputation. Certainly in the jazz world, no later composer has matched the breadth, the depth, the inspiration of Ellington's impressive oeuvre. And even when one casts a wider net, searching through the ranks of popular, academic, and classical composers, Ellington still stands among a select handful of masters, Copland, Gershwin, Ives, Joplin, Sousa, whose achievements represent the finest flowering of American music. Chapter 6. Modern Jazz. The Birth of Bebop. Long before modern jazz emerged as a distinctive style, an ideology of modernism had been implicitly embraced by the music's practitioners. From its earliest days, jazz had been a forward-looking art, continually incorporating new techniques, more expansive harmonies, more complex rhythms, more intricate melodies. Sometimes this ideology of progress was stated explicitly, as in Beiderbecke and the Chicagoans' oft-spoken praise of Stravinsky and other contemporary classical composers. In other instances, no words were necessary, as with the implicit modernism of Armstrong's breakthrough recordings of the 1920s. But whether they expostulated about the future of music or merely announced its arrival through the bells of their horns, the leading musicians of early jazz were modernists in the truest sense of the term. They were admired or chastised, as the case may be, as daring exponents of the new and bold. It is easy to lose sight of just how remarkable this modernist bent was, given its context. The concept of progress has played a modest role in most ethnic music traditions. Those who draw connections between jazz and African music miss this important difference. The griots of West Africa, for example, aim to preserve their cultural legacy as it is handed down to them. This is not a mere aesthetic choice, but a cultural imperative. They are the historians of their society and must maintain the integrity of their precious musical heritage. Such an attitude defies casual experimentation. In other pre-industrial settings, music partakes of a quasi-sacred efficacy. It may accompany a ritual or initiate a supernatural change. In such charged contexts, any modification in the music is viewed as a risky act, never encouraged, and at best tolerated with anxiety and distrust. Of course, musical practices have evolved over time, even in traditional non-Western cultures, but at the slowest of paces. Performers raised in such environments have only gradually and often with great reluctance accepted the Western concept of music as casual entertainment, with its attendant expectations of novelty, hence change, in the idiom. And it is far from clear whether this ostensibly more progressive Western attitude really represents progress for those whom, previously, music had partaken of the divine. Almost from the start, jazz players embraced a different mandate, accepting their role as entertainers and pursuing experimentation with an ardent zeal. This created a paradoxical foundation for jazz, one that remains to this day. For the jazz musician soon proved to be a restless soul, at one moment fostering the tradition, at another shattering it, mindless of the pieces. Even more striking, this progressive attitude of early jazz players came from members of America's most disempowered underclass. Recall that this music was not only viewed with apprehension by much of the ruling class, but was often belittled and derided even within Black America's own ranks. In the face of this hostility, simply preserving the African-American vernacular music heritage, saving the legacy of a Buddy Bolden or King Oliver from the oblivion that obscures the early history of most traditional forms of music, would have been a major achievement. But advancing the jazz idiom to produce an Ellington or Armstrong was nothing short of miraculous, and all in the span of a single generation. One searches in vain through all the countries of the world to find another example of such a rapid and dramatic transformation from folk music to art music. Given this feat, the rise of a more overt modernism in the early 1940s should not be viewed as an abrupt shift, as a major discontinuity in the music's history. It was simply an extension of jazz's inherent tendency to mutate, to change, to grow. Jazz had already revealed its ability to swallow other musical idioms, the march, the blues, the spiritual, the American popular song, the rag, and make them a part of itself. To do the same with Stravinsky and Hindemith, Schoenberg and Ravel presented, no doubt, an extraordinary challenge, but also an inevitable one. By the 1930s, the question now was not whether jazz would embrace modernism, but when and how and by whom. As early as 1931, journalists were comparing Ellington to Stravinsky and Ravel. A few years later, Benny Goodman made a more overt attempt to affiliate himself with contemporary classical music, commissioning works from Bartók, Hindemith, and Copland. And these were only the most prominent examples. Who can deny the modernist leanings of an Art Tatum, or a Coleman Hawkins, or a Don Redman, or a Bix Beiderbecke? The irony is that modern jazz sprang from none of these roots. It came neither from the Carnegie Hall concerts of Ellington and Goodman, nor from the virtuoso pianists of Harlem Stride, nor from the other experimental big band sounds of the swing era. True, it drew bits and pieces of inspiration from all these sources, but it sounded like none of them. Instead, the leading jazz modernists of the 1940s developed their own unique style, brash and unapologetic, in backrooms and after-hours clubs, at jam sessions and on the road with traveling bands. This music was not for commercial consumption, nor was it meant to be at this embryonic stage. It survived in the interstices of the jazz world. Its comings and goings were not announced in the newspaper of record. Its early stars were, at best, cult figures from beyond the fringe, not household names. Its evolution was not preserved on acetate by record companies. Our few glimpses into its early development come mostly from tapes or discs made by amateur engineers, enthusiasts willing to lug bulky equipment to nightclubs or private sessions where the new music was being made. In short, modern jazz was an underground movement, setting the pattern for all the future underground movements of the jazz world, initiating the bunker mentality that survives to this day in the world of progressive jazz. There is irony here, too. At a time when jazz was sweeping the nation, the music's next generation was moving further and further outside the mainstream of popular culture. What was this new music? Early modern jazz, or bebop, as it soon came to be called, rebelled against the populist trappings of swing music. The simple riffs, the accessible vocals, the orientation toward providing accompaniment to social dancing, the thick, big band textures built on interlocking brass and reed sections. These trademarks of pre-war jazz were set aside in favor of a more streamlined, more insistent style. Some things, of course, did not change. The 32-bar song form and the 12-bar blues remained cornerstones of the bebopper's repertoire. Frequently, bebop composers simply grafted an exotic name and a new, and usually more complex, melody onto the chords of earlier popular standards. For example, Thelonious Monk's 52nd Street theme borrowed the harmonies of I Got Rhythm, while Charlie Parker's Ornithology was a similar reworking of How High the Moon. The instrumentation of modern jazz also stayed true to pre-war models. Although the beboppers preferred the small combo format to the prevalent big band sound, the underlying rhythm section of piano, string bass, drums, and occasionally guitar went unchallenged, as did the use of saxophones, trumpets, and trombones as typical frontline instruments. Yet how these instruments were played underwent a sea change in the context of modern jazz. Improvised lines grew faster, more complex. The syncopations and dotted eighth note phrasings that had characterized earlier jazz were now far less prominent. Instead, long phrases might stay on the beat for measures at a time, built on a steady stream of eighth or sixteenth notes executed with quasi-mechanical precision, occasionally broken by a triplet, a pregnant pause, an interpolation of dotted eighths, or whirlwind 32nd notes, or a piercing, offbeat phrase. The conception of musical time also changed hand in hand with this new way of phrasing. Otherwise, this less syncopated approach might have sounded rhythmically lifeless, a tepid jazz equivalent to the even 16th notes of Baroque music. The 2-4 rhythmic feeling of New Orleans and Chicago was now completely replaced by the streamlined 4-4 sound favored by the Kansas City bands. But even more important, phrases often began and ended on the weak beats, 2 and 4, or increasingly between beats with unexpected points of emphasis adding to the querulous, incisive tone of the music. These characteristics imparted an off-balance quality to the proceedings and provided momentum for the solos, which now sometimes stretched on at great length, chorus after chorus. Above all, these crystalline improvisations were made vibrant by the breathless speed with which they were executed. Never before had instrumental technique been so central to the music's sound. Rarely had jazz tempos been so fast, or for that matter, so slow. The boppers were not afraid of even the most languid ballad tempos, but even in these instances their solos frequently implied a doubling of the stated time, staying true to the ethos of speed at all costs. The onomatopoeia of its nickname, at first rebop or bebop, eventually shortened further to a simple bop, was all too fitting. This was music built out of small jabs and feints, rather than the sucker-punch haymakers driven by straightforward syncopations of an Armstrong or Hawkins, a Beiderbecke or Bechet. The harmonic implications of this music also revealed a newfound complexity. Each of the major modern jazz composers delighted in certain trademark harmonic structures. Note Dizzy Gillespie's fondness for patterns that descend in whole or half steps, for example in Con Alma, or in his tautly conceived interlude to A Night in Tunisia, which unfolds with the austere precision of a Bach prelude. Or Charlie Parker's predilection for 2-5 substitutions in Confirmation, Blues for Alice, or the famous bridge to Coco, or, most iconoclastic of all, Thelonious Monk's mastery of dissonances and unconventional chord structures, so beyond the mainstream that over a generation would pass before Monk's more outré works became regular parts of the jazz repertoire. True, these devices had been used in jazz before, but never to such a degree. Ellington's keyboard work from the 1930s and 1940s was heavily laced with dissonance, but these avant-garde tendencies were evident only to careful listeners who detected the eccentric piano work that underlay the big band sound. And of course the chords of Coco were anything but new, having been borrowed wholesale from the swing standard Cherokee. But before Parker, few dared to solo on this rapid romp through the circle of fifths, and the hearty souls who did would have never tried it at the tempos that the boppers preferred. But more often, the harmonic complexity of modern jazz was implicit, suggested in the melody lines and improvisations rather than stated outright in the chords of the songs. After all, most bop compositions simply followed more or less the conventional progressions of pre-war standards. But even when working over the familiar territory of I Got Rhythm or the 12-bar blues, the boppers made heavy use of flatted ninths, sharpened elevenths, and other altered or higher intervals, to a degree unknown in earlier jazz. To gauge the full extent of this change, one need merely study the melody line to Donald E., Charlie Parker's reworking of the standard Indiana. The melody of Indiana is conventional, staying close to chord tones at all times, but Parker's piece immediately moves into deeper waters. Almost every bar features one or more altered tones, an augmented fifth, a major seventh played against a minor chord, a flatted ninth leading to a sharpened ninth, and the like. The composition as a whole is nothing less than a textbook example of how bop harmonic thinking revolutionized the flow of the melodic line in jazz. One recalls Parker's alleged statement that an improviser should be able to use any note against any chord. It was simply a matter of placing it in the right context. All in all, the 32 bars of Donnelly serve as a compact proof, almost Euclidean in its elegance, of this daring proposal. Yet there was also a core of simplicity to this music. Arrangements were sparse, almost to an extreme. Renouncing the thick textures of the big band sound, beboppers mostly opted for monophonic melody statements. And even when there were two or more horns in the band, the pairing of saxophone and trumpet was a typical front line for a bop ensemble, they usually played the melody in unison. The quest for extended compositional forms, the holy grail of jazz, held little fascination for modern jazz players. Their compositional forms were mostly ready to hand, drawn from the American popular song repertoire. The boppers were not formalists. Content, not form, was their preoccupation. Instrumental solos were at the heart of each performance, sandwiched between an opening and closing statement of the melody. Deviations from this recipe were rare. Occasionally, an interlude might be used between solos, as in Dizzy Gillespie's Salt Peanuts. Introductions or codas might be allowed, but they rarely lasted for more than four bars. The free play of improvisation was the thing. Amateur recordings of the day, such as the famous Charlie Parker tapes and discs made by Dean Benedetti, or Ralph Bass's searing account of Dexter Gordon and Wardell Gray battling over The Hunt, often leave out the melody statements entirely. The tape is not turned on until the solo start, almost as if the tune itself were inconsequential, like the advertisements and coming attractions that fill time before the feature film begins. The celebrated histories of Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie might lead one to believe that this musical revolution took place only on the front line, an upheaval among horn players. In fact, much of the changing sensibility of modern jazz was driven by the rhythm sections. In this regard, the rebel streak of modern jazz revealed its ample distance from the New Orleans-Chicago-New York triangle that had defined so much of the music's tradition. The rhythmic pulse of this new music instead traced its lineage to the Midwest and Southwest, and especially to Kansas City. The shimmering hi-hat sound of a Joe Jones, the crackling guitar lines of a Charlie Christian, the 4-4 walking lines of a Walter Page or a Jimmy Blanton, the sparse piano comping of a Count Basie, each anticipated crucial elements that would come to define the bebop rhythmic sensibility. Under such influences, each instrument in the jazz rhythm section underwent a transformation during these years. The pulse of the music became less sharply articulated, more pointillistic. Sudden accents, the so-called bass drum bombs dropped by bebop percussionists, or the crisp comping chords of pianists and guitarists, now frequently arrived off the beat or on weak beats. The dashing tempos required impeccable timekeeping and unprecedented stamina. After the onslaught of modern jazz, the rhythm section would never be the same. But musicological analysis only takes us so far. Bebop was defined by its social context as much as by the flats and sharps of its altered chords. Outsiders, even within the jazz world, the modern jazz players had the dubious distinction of belonging to an underclass within an underclass. Remember, this was a musical revolution made first and foremost by sidemen, not stars. Not by Benny Goodman, but by his guitarist, Charlie Christian. Not by Duke Ellington, but by his bassist, Jimmy Blanton. Not by Earl Hines, but by his saxophonist, Charlie Parker. Not by Cab Calloway, but by his trumpeter, Dizzy Gillespie. Not by Coleman Hawkins, but by his pianist, Thelonious Monk. Not by Louis Armstrong, but by his saxophonist, Dexter Gordon. Unfettered by the commercial pressures that beset the name bandleaders of the day, these obscure practitioners of an unheralded art were free to pursue the extreme implications of this new sound. These less-than-famous players relished the opportunity to make a statement with their music, and the more difficult it was, all the better. Little wonder that the resulting bebop style was, in sports parlance, in-your-face, a 20th-century African-American way of épater les bourgeois. The individualism of the beboppers was fired further by their marginal status as black Americans at a critical juncture in U.S. history. In this last generation before the end of segregation and the passage of the Civil Rights Act, African Americans were intent on testing the limits as never before. The first generation of jazz players had succeeded as entertainers, and white America was content to celebrate them on that level. But the black jazz players of the 1940s wanted more. They demanded acceptance as artists, as esteemed practitioners of a serious musical form. Previously, only a rare individual, a Scott Joplin or a Duke Ellington, aspired to these heights. But with the advent of bebop, a whole generation of black musicians was asserting itself as co-equals with the purveyors of highbrow culture, the classical composers, the dramatists, the poets, the painters, the sculptors. Another generation would pass before jazz musicians began attending music conservatories in large numbers, but already by the 1940s, the ethos that would inspire such ambitions was already evident. Thus, the birth of modern jazz took place at a strange crossroads, drawing, on the one side, from the pungent roots and rhythms of Kansas City jazz, on the other, delving into the rarefied atmosphere of high art. If a contradiction existed, it was exemplified most concretely in the music and abbreviated career of Charlie Parker. Parker the highbrow? One could sense it when, calling his sidemen to the bandstand, he summoned them by playing a snippet of Hindemith on the alto, or when he identified Stravinsky's The Song of the Nightingale during a blindfold test conducted for Downbeat in 1948. "Give that all the stars you've got," he told interviewer Leonard Feather, and went on to discuss Prokofiev, Hindemith, Debussy, and Ravel. Or when, at the peak of his career, he announced his intention of taking composition lessons from the visionary classical composer Edgar Varèse. Parker, the Kansas City jazz stalwart? This was his other equally valid lineage. Who could deny it after hearing the bittersweet lament of Parker's mood, as deep a statement of the blues as exists in the jazz tradition? Jazz's past and future intersect in the life and times of this seminal figure. Born in Kansas City, Kansas on August 29, 1920, and moving across the border to Kansas City, Missouri at age 7, Parker imbibed this tradition at its source, his formative years coinciding with the Pendergast era of semi-legal vice with a jazz accompaniment. Like many of his generation, Parker learned jazz through recordings as well as at first hand. But most of his major influences were linked to his Kansas City environs. Above all, Lester Young, whose recorded solos Parker learned note for note, influenced the youngster with a linear conception of improvisation, one that indirectly set the foundation for modern jazz. But two early employers also left their stamp on Parker's music. Saxophonist Buster Smith, a mainstay of Kansas City jazz, who had worked with the Blue Devils and Benny Moten by the time he hired 17-year-old Charlie Parker for his own band in 1937, and Jay McShann, the quintessential KC pianist and master of blues-drenched swing, who helped bring Parker to a national audience a short while later. Parker's father, Charles Sr., had worked the Black Theater circuit as a pianist, singer, and dancer before settling in Kansas City. After his son's birth, he was rarely at home, both because of his drinking, which was forbidden in the household, and his second career as a chef on a Pullman line. Before Charlie's 10th birthday, his father had left the household for good. The task of rearing the youngster fell to Parker's mother, Addie, a strong-willed and religious woman who made ends meet through a variety of jobs, taking in boarders, doing laundry, working as a charwoman. Parker was, by all accounts, a mama's boy, coddled and pampered by his doting mother. "That's what I worked for and what I lived for, that boy," she told an interviewer years later, inconsolable after her son's early death. Parker's first flirtation with music was spurred by an unlikely source. Around the time he entered high school, the youngster heard a radio broadcast featuring the saxophone work of Rudy Valley, a saccharine crooner more remembered for his stylized vocals than as a horn player. Responding to her son's urgings, Addie Parker purchased a used alto saxophone for $45. The youngster briefly studied music at Lincoln High School, where Walter Page and a host of Kansas City jazzmen had trained before him, but soon became disappointed with the baritone horn he was assigned in the school band. "All I did was play coop, 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 coop," he recalled in the 1950 interview. His interest was rekindled when he began associating with older students whose musical interests tended toward jazz. Parker was no saxophone prodigy. The various accounts of his early musical activities stress enthusiasm rather than depth of talent. A famous anecdote tells of the young altoist's humiliation at a jam session presided over by drummer Joe Jones of the Count Basie Band. Struggling with the tempo, Parker faltered on the sax, but continued to press on, until Jones imperiously dismissed the youngster by picking up a cymbal from his kit and lofting it through the air to crash at the altoist's feet. Amid derisive laughter, Parker made his way off the bandstand. Rather than be discouraged by this public failure, Parker practiced with even greater determination. During a summer stint playing and practicing at a resort in the Ozarks, he studied the recordings Lester Young had made with the Count Basie Band and deepened his knowledge of music theory. We can only speculate on Parker's progress during this period, but his rapid ascension after the Ozarks gig to higher profile engagements with better-known musicians suggests that the hard work was now paying off. At the close of summer, Parker was hired to play second alto in Buster Smith's band, and the Kansas City veteran now served as a mentor for the teenager. In Smith's group, he worked alongside pianist Jay McShann, who would soon be featuring Parker in his own band. Parker later claimed, in a notorious aside, that he had begun dissipating at age 12 and using heroin by age 15. An exaggeration perhaps, but only a slight one. An indifferent student, Parker left Lincoln High School before his sophomore year. By age 16, Parker was married with a pregnant wife and working as a professional musician. Sometime during the next year, first wife Rebecca Ruffin asserts, he began using intravenous drugs. After leaving Buster Smith, Parker played for a few weeks with Jay McShann before taking to the road, not as a part of a traveling band, but merely as a wandering vagabond. In Chicago, he caught the attention of Billy Eckstein, as much for his unkempt appearance as for his superlative alto playing. The raggedest guy you'd want to see, Eckstein recalled years later, but playing like you never heard. Later, he made his way to New York, and he worked as a dishwasher at a Harlem night spot where Art Tatum played. Like Armstrong and Ellington before him, Parker failed to take New York by storm on his first visit. After gigging sporadically and trying his hand at various local jam sessions, he soon retreated to Kansas City, ostensibly for his father's funeral. Around this same time, he acquired the nickname Yardbird, often shortened to Bird. Accounts of how he earned this sobriquet differ. It may have initially referred to nothing more than an appetite for poultry, but eventually it took on a larger significance, representing to his fans the unprecedented free-flying creativity of his alto sax lines. The survival of an amateur recording of Parker from this period provides us with a first insight into the path-breaking approach to improvisation he was in the process of developing. The precise dating of this workout over the changes of Honeysuckle Rose and Body and Soul has generated much debate. Some have placed it as early as 1937, others as late as 1940. Parker's apparent allusions to a Roy Eldridge and Chu Berry recording of Body and Soul from 1938 and to the melody of Jimmy Van Heusen's I Thought About You, copyrighted and first recorded in 1939, suggest that the document comes from the latter end of this period. Moreover, the maturity of Parker's conception also supports a recording date of around 1940, after his return to Kansas City from his Chicago and Harlem experiences. After all, Parker later claimed that his initial breakthrough, a realization that the higher intervals of the chord could serve as the basic springboard for melodic improvisation, took place during this New York visit, and the Honeysuckle Rose Body and Soul performance makes liberal use of this technique. This is no student exercise. No other saxophonist of the day, Hawkins or Young included, was delving this deeply into advanced harmony. The relaxed virtuosity of his later recordings is notably absent. The phrasing is still stiff, but Parker's conceptual understanding is frighteningly mature. Soon after returning to Kansas City, Parker rejoined McShann, with whom he would stay for most of the next 2 years. His solos graced a number of McShann recordings from this period, commercial sides as well as amateur transcriptions, and attracted a small cadre of admirers, albeit mostly among other musicians rather than the general public. Especially revealing are performances from November 1940, recorded at a local radio station by several ardent Wichita University jazz fans. On Lady Be Good, Parker shows that he has mastered the mannerisms of Lester Young, even including a passing allusion to Mean to Me, in crafting a polished, if somewhat derivative, solo. But once again on Honeysuckle Rose, Parker distinguishes himself with a commanding improvisation, daring in its melodic thrusts and executed with fluidity. Several months later, McShann began recording commercially for Decca, and Parker's solo contributions again stand out. On The Jumpin' Blues, Parker opens his improvisation with a willowy extended phrase that anticipates the unadulterated bebop of his later composition, Ornithology. This is the saxophonist's strongest recorded work to date, confirmed further by Sapien Bounce and Swingmatism from the same period. Although the influence of Lester Young has been frequently highlighted, and no doubt proved crucial in Parker's musical development, the altoist clearly drew inspiration from a variety of other sources during the late 1930s and early 1940s. Parker's early recordings show the wide range of his musical tastes. A hotel room jam session, preserved on disc by Bob Redcross in February 1943, finds him quoting Ben Webster's solo on Cottontail. Other amateur sides show Parker alluding to Coleman Hawkins's landmark improvisation on Body and Soul. An even more unusual addition to the Parker discography from this period captures the altoist practicing over a recording of the Benny Goodman Trio. At other points, momentary echoes of Willie Smith and Johnny Hodges can be heard in his playing. The lithe phrasing of Young overlays all these sources, providing the basic melodic prism through which the other influences were filtered. A few years later, the jazz press would depict Parker and the other beboppers as rebels who had rejected the swing tradition. but a much different lesson can be drawn from these recordings of bop in transition. The stylistic leap made by Parker and the other beboppers would have been impossible without careful study of the earlier pioneers of jazz tradition. But even the most careful genealogical tracing of Parker's sources fails to explain the unique sound of his alto saxophone. There are no predecessors, neither Lester nor Hawk, Hodges nor Carter, in this regard. A utilitarian philosophy, emphasizing economy of means, appears to be at work here. Each note is articulated with focused energy, each phrase smoothly executed but infused with an acerbic aftertaste. Phrases start and end with crisp precision. No moody rubato timing stretches out the melodic line. There are no lingering breaths a la Ben Webster to impart an expansive, velvety quality to the music. Each phrase is attacked with clear intent. All in all, no saxophonist before Parker had such a cutting sound. As such, his influence on later jazz players has been enormous. After Parker, the more warm and rounded tone of a Benny Carter or Johnny Hodges became passé, their diffused romanticism replaced by a surgical sharpness of attack. For all their differences, the testosterone-infused sounds of later jazz saxophonists, Rollins, Coltrane, Coleman, would not have been possible without Parker's pioneering model. This, too, was part of the boppers' rebellion against the pop music pretensions of swing-era jazz. The sentimental trappings, the influence of the sweet bands, the various ways the rough edges of jazz music had been softened for consumption by a mass audience, these elements were now to be purged in favor of a purer conception of jazz, an art music with the emotional pungency of a battle cry. Slow dancers seeking a romantic interlude were now advised to keep their distance from the jazz bandstand. In 1940, the Cab Calloway Band came to Kansas City with a young trumpeter named John Gillespie, already dubbed Dizzy by his colleagues, in the horn section. During an intermission, trumpeter Buddy Anderson told Gillespie about a local saxophonist who was well worth hearing. Gillespie later recalled his low expectations. "Oh man," I said, "a saxophone player? I'm playing with Chu Berry, and I know Benny Carter and played with Coleman Hawkins, and I know Lester Young." Gillespie, despite his youth, was already one of the most harmonically and technically adept trumpeters of the day and was not prepared to be impressed. However, Anderson persisted, and the following day arranged for the two to engage in an impromptu jam session, with Gillespie comping on piano and Parker playing alto. The meeting would prove to be a major turning point in both careers. "I was astounded by what the guy could do," Gillespie continued the story. "These other guys that I had been playing with weren't my colleagues, really. But the moment I heard Charlie Parker, I said, 'There is my colleague.' Charlie Parker and I were moving in practically the same direction, too, but neither of us knew it." Gillespie had traveled a much different route in reaching this defining moment in his musical development. Unlike Parker, who had been schooled in the midst of a burgeoning jazz scene, Gillespie had come of age in the backwoods of Shirah, South Carolina. The last of nine children, only seven of us lived long enough to get a name, John Burks Gillespie was raised by an indifferent mother and an abusive father. Every Sunday morning, Papa would whip us. That's mainly how I remember him. The elder Mr. Gillespie was a bricklayer who played piano with a local band on the weekends. He also agreed to store the instruments at his home during the week to prevent a down-and-out sideman from pawning one in between gigs. The house's front room had the cluttered look of a used instrument shop. Its furnishings included a piano, a set of drums, a mandolin, a guitar, and a red one-string bass fiddle. From an early age, John Burks learned about the sound, the feel of these different musical toys. Support and encouragement came mostly outside the home, from neighbors and teachers. During fifth grade, Gillespie was enlisted into the school band. The youngest student in the ensemble, he had last choice of the available instruments, and was assigned a slide trombone that was several inches too large for his meager arm span. Undeterred, Gillespie practiced diligently, and soon was borrowing a neighbor's trumpet, which he also learned to play. By age 12, he had acquired a rudimentary technique on both horns, but increasingly gravitated toward the trumpet. Opportunities to perform were soon coming his way. In this sheltered environment, the youngster could develop a sense of identity and mastery as a musician that would not have been possible in a Kansas City or New York. Gillespie prided himself on being the best young trumpeter around Shirah. In fact, he could only play in one key at the time and struggled to read music. In an encounter reminiscent of Parker's humiliation at the hands of Joe Jones, Gillespie's pretensions to expertise were shattered when a local trumpeter who had been gigging in Philadelphia came back to Sherrod to visit his family. "He cut me seriously," Gillespie later recalled. "Sonny counted down and started playing in the key of C, but all I could do was fumble around because I couldn't find one note on the trumpet. I felt so crushed, I cried, because I was supposed to be the town's best trumpet player." A sociology of jazz could glean much from these accounts of jam session disgraces. Such public embarrassments would stand as a frequent rite of passage for the modern jazz musician. Years later, both Parker and Gillespie would play similar mind games on other lesser players. At the early 1940 sessions at Minton's and Monroe's, the Harlem clubs where the bebop vocabulary was refined, the Cognoscenti used fast tempos and complex melody lines to intimidate outsiders and establish their own credentials. In a setting where conservatory degrees were still unknown, one's curriculum vitae was earned every night on the bandstand. This combative macho culture is rarely discussed, but remains a core value within the jazz community. In the biographies of Parker and Gillespie, and numerous other players, these painful setbacks take on the luster of defining moments, described with a fervor that recalls the hackneyed adage about separating the men from the boys. The accepted jazz cliché about paying one's dues puts a more socially acceptable twist on this whole ritual, making it sound, after all, like some sort of economic transaction, but ignores the undercurrent of aggression that infuses this darker side to the jazz mindset. Who knows what modern jazz would have sounded like without this persistent desire for one-upmanship? In Gillespie's case, as in Parker's before him, the youngster now studied the horn with renewed dedication. Within months, he had learned to play with ease in several keys. By the time he was 15, Gillespie felt confident enough to sit in with the visiting jazz bands that performed at the Sherrod Elks Hall. But the music that came to Sherrod over the airwaves had an even more profound effect on him. The Gillespie household possessed neither a gramophone nor a radio, but a neighbor who owned both let the teenager stop by to use them. Broadcasts featuring the Teddy Hill Orchestra, captured in performance at Harlem Savoy Ballroom, would make the strongest impression on Gillespie. The youngster paid particular attention to Hill's trumpeter Roy Eldridge, who would remain the dominant model for Gillespie as he strived to create his own approach to the horn. The solid technique, the rhythmic excitement, the commanding range, these same qualities that he so admired in the elder trumpeter's playing, would later infuse Gillespie's own virtuosic conception of the instrument. One measure of how well he succeeded would come several years later when he joined the Teddy Hill Band himself, filling the same role that Eldridge had held before him. In fall 1933, Gillespie entered the Laurinburg Institute in North Carolina, where he pursued the formal study of music. His grasp of harmony was further enriched by his work on the piano, where he tried out chord structures and, in later years, wrote most of his compositions and arrangements. In spring 1935, his family moved to Philadelphia, and the youngster followed a few months later. Here, he began working odd jobs as a professional musician and associating with other aspiring young trumpeters, in particular his cousin Charlie Shavers, 3 months older than Dizzy, who had come to prominence as a soloist with the John Kirby Sextet, one of the finer small combos of its day, and later with the Tommy Dorsey Big Band. Shavers shared Gillespie's enthusiasm for Roy Eldridge, and they both memorized Eldridge's solos and began playing them note for note on gigs. The Eldridge sound would continue to linger in the background of Gillespie's playing long after he developed his mature style, and would give a veneer of swing-era traditionalism to even Dizzy's most experimental work. And perhaps it was Eldridge's model that led Gillespie to retain a strong sense of syncopation in his playing, while other beboppers, especially Parker, favored more flowing lines. Moreover, Gillespie would often break up the long melodic lines, so favored by modern jazz players, with short, jagged phrases and virtuosic leaps into the higher register of the horn, both mannerisms also reminiscent of Eldridge. These elements of showmanship, which connected Dizzy to the pre-bop tradition of jazz trumpet, not just Eldridge, but back further to Armstrong, were also appreciated by the general public, who accorded Gillespie a fame and following that no other bebopper enjoyed. In 1937, Gillespie, only 19 years old, moved to New York. Here he stayed with his brother and experienced the wide range of music the city had to offer. He frequented the Savoy Ballroom, sat in with Chick Webb, met the great Cuban trumpeter Mario Bassa, who helped spur an interest in Latin rhythms that would have a lasting influence on Gillespie's music, and began to make a reputation for himself as an up-and-coming trumpeter. A chance encounter with Teddy Hill at the Savoy Ballroom led to Gillespie joining Hill's band for a European tour. His solos on the band's May 1937 recordings of King Porter Stomp and Blue Rhythm Fantasy make clear that Gillespie was already a skillful imitator of Eldridge's work. The addition of Kenny Clarke to the Teddy Hill band brought Gillespie into close contact with a drummer who would help transform the rhythmic pulse in modern jazz. A Pittsburgh native who had apprenticed in a wide range of bands in the Midwest.